Good morning, everyone. Welcome. My name's Kate McMillan, and I'm a former member of this list. And it's been a great pleasure to come along this morning and introduce this morning's speakers. The first speaker is David Bailey, and he's going to speak for approximately half an hour, and then we'll have a break for 5 minutes, and then the second speaker is Amy Kinder. And then at the end, we'll have some time for questions, but I'm told that we have to be out of here at 8:45 on the dot. Many of you will know David Bailey. He's been in practice for 35 years, and he seems to acknowledge that by his email address because he's called Old Bailey at Vic Bar. But he has had an illustrious career practising in the commercial area and corporate and banking. But many of you will also know him as one of the authors of Williams Civil Procedure. Could I welcome David to come and speak on his topic of undertakings?
Thank you, Your Honour. Well, I was just saying to Her Honour, as luck would have it, I have to give an undertaking to the court this morning on behalf of a client. So this topic loomed large in my thinking last night. I thought, what could possibly go wrong? And then I thought of all the things I'm going to tell you this morning. I think one starts off with the premise that an undertaking is simply a promise to do something or to refrain from doing something which one expects to be capable of performance, and the law imposes particular duties on lawyers that give undertakings because of part of the supervisory role of the court in ensuring that its officers conduct themselves properly. Now, what I've done in the paper is to extract a whole series of different sorts of undertakings, and there's no real logic in some way to the collection. It's just things that I was able to come across. If there's one unifying theme, it's this, and that is that an undertaking is regarded as a serious obligation which is enforceable of itself. So there doesn't need to be any consideration for it, although if there is, that can lead to other consequences. It's enforced just as if it was in the nature of an injunction or an order of the court that you would perform what you've undertaken to do. Now, just running through a few observations, I've said at the start that my comments are somewhat in terrorem, but that ought not to prevent us from giving undertakings. It's just that when one does, one needs to be mindful of the issues that can arise. Now, I've headed the topic undertakings by lawyers. For practical purposes, there's no real difference between undertakings given by solicitors and undertakings by barristers. I will draw attention to a few differences as I go along, but in the eyes of the court, all its officers are equally bound by the undertakings that they give. Now, at the start of the paper, I've got a quote from Lord Justice Balcombe in the case of Oodle and Capri Lighting. This particular judgment was referred to by our Court of Appeal in a case called Morgan in the state of Victoria, which I'll talk about in some detail. But the Court of Appeal referred to this judgment because Lord Justice Balcombe set out comprehensively what he had been able to ascertain as being the content of a lawyer's duties with respect to undertakings, and referred to the court's jurisdiction as coming from its inherent jurisdiction, and it's preserved under our Supreme Court Act as being one of the inherent powers of the court. He was referring to solicitors in this case, but I think these remarks are equally applicable to barristers. Failure to implement a solicitor's undertaking is prima facie to be regarded as misconduct on his part, and this is so even if he's not being guilty of dishonourable conduct. So what Lord Justice Balcombe is saying there is the court is enforcing the undertaking not to punish someone, but simply to ensure that the undertaking is carried out, so that the primary focus of the court is not on punishing people for misconduct. However, as we'll see when we come to the Legal Profession Act, breach of undertaking can give rise to... don't know whether that's being something from handed down from the Almighty about undertakings, but let's go on. The court is concerned to see that the undertaking is carried out as a primary focus. And Lord Justice Falcon goes on to say, however, exceptionally, the solicitor may be able to give an explanation for his failure to honour his undertaking, which may enable the court to say there's been no misconduct in the particular case, as one would expect, of course. And the ultimate enforcement of a breach of an undertaking can mean that you would be liable for a civil contempt. But of course, one has to regard that as the absolute high watermark of enforcement of an undertaking. Normally, the court would expect in the first instance that the undertaking is carried out, perhaps with some further order or warning, but civil contempt charge is to be regarded as the ultimate sanction. I won't go through page 3 in great detail, except I'll end with that analysis by saying to be enforceable, an undertaking must be clear, obviously, and that in itself gives rise to some problems that we'll see in a moment. Be capable of performance at the time it's made. In other words, you can't have an obligation which is so vague or incapable of being tied down to some particular point of time that it just becomes nebulous. And then finally, so be given by the lawyer in his or her professional capacity. And that is something which we need to analyse a bit further as well. Now, I pause there to refer again to Morgan and the State of Victoria. The enforcement by the court is done in a summary way as part of its jurisdiction over its officers, and that jurisdiction is expressly preserved under the Legal Profession Act of 2004. When one turns to the Act, one finds that undertakings have a connotation for professional misconduct. And I go through there the definition of professional misconduct, but underlining that concept of sounding in misconduct, if there's been a breach of an undertaking, one finds a list in section 4.4.4 that certain listed types of conduct are capable of constituting unsatisfactory conduct or professional misconduct. And these include a contravention of the Act, the regulations, or the legal profession rules. And then one drills down into the Act further and finds that misconduct also refers to the willful or reckless failure to comply with an undertaking given to a court, tribunal, the commissioner or the board by an Australian legal practitioner, thereby picking up barristers and solicitors and corporate lawyers. Now, so you get the words willful or reckless failure, which connotes, from how I see it, as being some contumelious behaviour where you're aware that the undertaking hasn't been performed and you do nothing to ensure that it is performed. An example would be you've given an undertaking to a fellow practitioner, perhaps in a letter. The fellow practitioner says, well, you haven't done whatever it is, let's just say the payment of a sum of money or the withdrawal of a caveat or something like that. There's a change of heart on the part of your client. You say, well, no, we're not going to comply with that undertaking. We want to modify it in such and such a way. Well, that can be a showstopper if the undertaking is not then performed. And this is a problem, and the problem I'm facing, I suppose, in my own mind this morning is one has to try and forecast what might go wrong. And I've got a couple of cases I've extracted from the VCAT jurisdiction further on in the paper, and I think might be worth just looking at those now in the concept in the context of what constitutes misconduct. The first of those cases, Legal Services Commissioner Sapuntsis, it's page 7. Now this is starts off with a pretty innocuous sort of undertaking, I think we can all relate to this. There's a change of practitioners on a matter. Practitioner S writes in a letter to the other practitioner seeking release of documents from the other practitioner. These words, in return of the documents, we undertake to pay your costs and we'll be sending a courier to collect the documents at 3 p.m. Well, the documents were collected, but no bill of costs had been raised at that point of time. And then, perhaps with an afterthought, the practitioner wrote a further letter referring to the payment of costs but expressing reservation of the right to object to quantum and to seek a detailed bill. Then after that, the other solicitor submitted a bill, $8,723, a few days later, and obviously some difficulty developed between the new solicitor and the new solicitor's client, such that the client became very difficult in terms of payment of the previous solicitor's costs. And a dispute evolved, and payment of the costs was not made for some months, I think about 7 or 8 months. Now, the VCAT, a charge was brought against the hapless practitioner, and what you see in the judgment is the member of the tribunal going through the letter in stages to try to get the content of what the undertaking was. The use of expression we in the member's eyes imply the practitioner gave the undertaking personally and not the client. And I think that's very important, that we need to be clear as to what we're undertaking to do. Now, if we're giving a personal undertaking, it's a very different thing to simply saying, well, my client will do X. I undertake that my client will do X. Now, if, let's suppose, the client then terminates the lawyer's retainer, the lawyer, of course, has got no longer any capacity to ensure that the undertaking's carried out. And so it's very important to work out who's giving the undertaking. Of course, my recommendation is always make it an undertaking on behalf of your client, not yourself, if at all possible. Now, what happened with the lawyer in this case was that the tribunal said that there'd been a breach of the undertaking. It was implied that the cost would be paid within a reasonable time after they are rendered, and that in the member's opinion that was 30 days plus a couple of days for service of the bill. The member obviously felt very sorry for the practitioner because the practitioner had paid the cost personally, so the practitioner's out of pocket for $8,000. The tribunal issued a reprimand and ordered that the practitioner pay the tribunal's costs, the Legal Services Commissioner's costs. Interesting are the words of the member, I think, and I've extracted them for you, paragraph 26. Refers to an undertaking not being something given lightly. It's a personal promise by a legal practitioner, and this is important, it's a mechanism whereby practical courses of action can be taken based upon the reliance by one legal practitioner upon the undertaking of another that the contents of that undertaking will be observed. And he goes on to say, if there's not such a requirement, there would be a breakdown in what's a very important mechanism employed by members of the profession. The breach of an undertaking strikes at the heart of such a system. So I think that's the real practical nub of why undertakings are important. Not so much to punish people if they're not carried out, but rather just so that the machinery of what we do works in a satisfactory and orderly way. And that I think one of the benefit of undertakings is that it does make the system work, and that if we do them properly, then as between practitioners, things will get done and we can rely on each other's word. Now, I was asked when I gave this paper in a slightly different form before, I was asked by a practitioner, well, can you be forced to accept an undertaking? I haven't been able to find any authority on that. My response was, I think under the Civil Procedure Act, there might be an argument that if you unreasonably reject an undertaking which is put forward to try and find a way around a problem, then maybe the court can take that into account. It might have a cost consequence or something of that nature. I can't see that it would have necessarily a disciplinary context, because there is a principle that the court cannot force a practitioner to give an undertaking. You have the right to say, no, I can't give that undertaking, or I won't give the undertaking for whatever reason. So that I think that it's going to stop somewhere short of being something which you can be forced to do, but it may have a cost consequence if there's perhaps an element of unreasonableness about it. But as I say, I couldn't find any authority about it. Maybe someone's come across it, and we'll find out during the questions. Now, the second case I've referred to is rather more serious than the first one. The first one, I think we can all probably relate to practitioner giving a letter out like that saying, well, we'll pick up the file and we'll see your costs are paid. Pretty simple undertaking, which can easily go wrong, unfortunately. But in the next one, the D'Alessandro case, there was obviously a rather heavily disputed de facto marriage matter, and there was a title of property in the name of the de facto wife or former wife, and the husband had lodged a caveat on it, and the property had been sold, and it was simply a question of getting the caveat lifted pending the resolution of the dispute and creating a fund of money from the sale and looking after that fund of money until the dispute was resolved. A common enough situation we've all probably faced from time to time. So the practitioner wrote a letter, this is a practitioner seeking the withdrawal of caveat, wrote a letter giving an undertaking that if the caveat's released, the sale would go through, he would manage the funds in an investment account and then account for them at the end of a period. Now, what in fact happened was there was a breakdown, obviously, in the relationship between the practitioners and the parties, and the investment never actually took place. There was some issue about getting authority and ABN numbers and things of that nature. So the funds simply sat in the trust account, and after a time, there was a further letter written by the practitioner to the other practitioner, trying to obviously vary the undertaking or do something to alter the terms upon which the funds had been obtained. And then further time elapsed, and the practitioner started to disperse the funds in various ways, and as I've set out there in the facts. Now, the matter came before the tribunal, and in this case the member took a rather more dim view of what had happened. He says here, it was suggested Mr. D had lost control over his client, but this was not accepted as detracting from the undertaking given. And then the member, the same member who sat on the previous case, reiterated the importance of undertakings. And he referred there to the relevant conduct rules applying to solicitors. That's Rule 22 of the conduct rules, which I've set out in the paper. And says undertakings are routinely given and a very effective mechanism for expediting matters and ensuring they're done correctly. Standing behind the giving of undertakings, the understanding on the part of members of the profession that undertakings will be adhered to. Now, in this case, the practitioner not only was dealt with by imposing a costs order, but also had to pay a fine, so that that was a mark of the tribunal's concern over what appeared to be a rather flagrant or careless attention to what the undertaking required. I think both cases illustrate the problems that over time circumstances might change so it becomes harder to deal with what you've undertaken to do. Well, what do you do about that? And that's a problem in practice, is that I suppose in the first instance you could go to your fellow practitioner and say, look, we've got this problem's arisen. Can we work out some way of altering the undertaking which will still be in the interest of both our clients? Now, obviously, that can be quite tricky, particularly in these situations where you've got a very strong dispute going on. Nevertheless, I think that's the first step one ought to pursue. Maybe you sound out your colleague in a telephone conversation without putting anything specific in a letter until you get some feeling for how the matter might be resolved. But if that doesn't work, then probably your only way out is to go to court or at least go to the Legal Services Board, which may seem a bit heavy, but I think in the end, that's really the only safety valve that I can see that would ultimately exist. My preference would be probably to approach the court, because the problem of going to the LSB is not so much that they may not resolve it in the long run, but it may just take time, and it may well be that the LSB says you've got to go off to court. So my preference would be to hit the nail on the head and go straight to the court to try and get a release, or to get a variation, or try and do something to relieve you from the difficulties that the undertaking may have given rise to. Now, I then go on to talk about types of undertakings, because I think in this room we might all be saying, well, I never give undertakings, or hardly ever arises. But when you start to look back on your career, I think, well, I don't give undertakings very often. Well, I've got to give one this morning. And then there's always the undertaking as to damages in the injunction cases. And then, of course, there's when we in these big discovery matters these days, one is sometimes asked to give a confidentiality undertaking because there's sensitive material. And I've given a number of those over the years. And I'd hate to think whether they still apply or not. I mean, obviously they still apply, but what the consequences might be. One idea which comes out of the barrister's rules is that one ought to keep a record of undertakings given. So quite apart from your briefs or your files, that you keep a notebook where you keep a note of important matters, and some of those important matters will be when and where you've given an undertaking and what its terms are, so that you're able to rely on that if it ever becomes an issue. Now, also in types of undertaking, I've set out there for you some of the court rules about undertakings as to damages. Another very important area is where you give undertakings in relation to things like freezing orders or Mareva injunctions, as they're once known, and Anton Pillar orders, or search orders, as they're now known. The rules there are, or sorry, the practice notes there are very strong as to the exact form of undertakings required, and of course they do impose very strict obligations on lawyers. I've talked about confidentiality undertakings, I won't go into those any further. Now, sometimes people will say, well, how do I know that a party's got the capacity to meet an undertaking? That might arise, for example, if there's an undertaking as to security for costs. Or, and it arises in this way sometimes, you have a foreign litigant that has to give an undertaking. There's a further implied obligation there that the foreign litigant must be able to support the undertaking. And I've given an example of a recent case where that was carried out in some major litigation where I think funds were paid into the solicitor's trust account for some millions of dollars. Now, I've talked about implied undertakings. I said this was a fairly disparate paper because the High Court now tells us that implied undertakings aren't undertakings at all, but I think conveniently for us, we're all aware of the implied undertaking which arises in the context of discovery. It's about the only instance I can find where you have an implied undertaking, but there may be other ones. It arises by operation of law, and it's enforceable by the court in the same way as any other undertaking, so it's a very serious undertaking. The problem is, I think, that one ought to be aware of what it applies to. Let's suppose you have a discovery matter and you become aware of information in the course of discovery. The obligation is that you can only use the discovered documents for the purposes of litigation and not for any collateral or other purpose. If you want to use it for some other purpose, you must go to the court to get a release of the undertaking. And there's been a lot of law about that. I've extracted for you some of the judicial pronouncements about when the undertaking will be varied. And it ought not to be assumed that just anything will constitute special circumstances. You've got to be able to demonstrate to the court that there's a very good reason to have the undertaking released. And I've listed there for you a recent decision of Justice Vickery, where I think that was a, may have been a defamation case, I can't recall. But anyway, His Honour was not prepared to release it in that case. Now, I guess one of the problems about implied undertakings is that how long do they go on for? Well, the answer is they probably go on forever in terms of never disclosing information otherwise than using it for the purposes of the litigation. But there have been a number of instances where the undertaking is determined to be released. The case of Esso Australia and Plowman was a case where documents were read in open court, and Justice Mason said that in that instance, once the document had in effect entered the public domain or the public forum, the undertaking would be released. But there are qualifications on that. Subsequent cases have shown, for example, Deputy Commissioner of Taxation in Carras stands for proposition that simply by filing an affidavit in a proceeding doesn't mean that the undertaking is released as to the content of the affidavit. It would have to be read in court and accepted as into the evidence in the proceeding before you could be safely accept that there may have been a release of the undertaking. Now, I then turn to looking at an analogous undertaking which is now imposed by the Civil Procedure Act, where in relation to the obligation to make disclosure of documents, the Act has imposed a duty on the recipient under Section 26 and 27 of the Civil Procedure Act. It's been recently held that in relation to a release of that obligation, the court will apply the same principles it does in respect of implied undertakings. That case is Barrow and McLernan. Now, the last part of the paper is, the hard bit, and that is what happens if there's a breach of an undertaking which has consequences. I've given you some authorities there about, for example, if there's a need to enforce an undertaking as to damages for an injunction, how do you assess the damages? And there's been some recent law on that. But what about the case where you need to, the practitioner's conduct is such that proceedings for civil contempt are initiated. Now, fortunately, and I think one of the good things that comes out of Morgan and the State of Victoria is the Court of Appeal says that fortunately these cases are rare, meaning I think in subtext that the profession generally stands by undertakings. That was a case where it was an undertaking as to payment of costs by a practitioner, and as the litigation evolved, circumstances changed and the costs weren't paid. The other side, being the State of Victoria, took a very dim view of that and took civil contempt proceedings. And the court would not punish the practitioner for civil contempt because the court said before you can have an obligation to pay money, there's got to be an order. There's got to be an amount of money which is determined. There has to be a period of time it has to be paid by, and those elements were missing. And on that basis, the practitioner was relieved of being liable for civil contempt. But it's a very useful case in terms of a summary of all the relevant principles, and I think a useful summary of what the court would regard as contumelious behaviour in the context of an undertaking. And I'd recommend that one if you wanted to read one authority which gives you as much as you need. That's probably the case. Well, I see we've hit 8 o'clock, so okay. Is that convenient? Mm-hmm. Thank you.